The recordings are started.
Thank you so much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Thomas Rickert, and I'm the GNSO appointed co-chair to the CCWG. And I would like to welcome all of you to this 76th call of the CCWG on the 12th of January 2016. And as usual, we would like to do the roll call based on attendance in the remote participation room. So I would like those who are on the audio bridge only to speak up so that we can add them to the list of attendees.
This is Steve Crocker. I'm trying to get into the Adobe room, but I'm not there yet.
Yeah, okay. Simon Bruce talking.
Same for Bruce.
Here from Rosemary.
And Rosemary, welcome all of you. And I see in the chat that Barak is on audio only and muted also. Anyone else? Good. Thanks, everyone. Can I also ask whether there are any updates to statements of interest? There don't seem to be any, which allows us to move into the second agenda item. And you will have noted, which is quite unusual, that I'm doing two agenda items in a row. That is because I have to leave the AC room in roughly an hour. So don't be surprised if I'm disappearing. That's not a lack of interest. So the next agenda item is the second discussion on recommendation 4, or to be specific, on an aspect of recommendation 4 with respect to board removal liability. And I'd like staff to bring up the recently circulated document up in the Adobe room. It has been circulated only a couple of hours ago, but we just made some minor tweaks in terms of language to the document that you already know. I suggest that we jointly go through what's been changed to check whether everyone's happy with that. And this is sort of a pattern that you will see with the other recommendations as well. We have discussed recommendation 4 exactly 1 week ago, so we're going to bring that up today again. The same goes for recommendation number 12, which we've heard last week as well, and then we're going to go to new recommendations, if you wish, to have them in our first reading. So you will see at least two sessions with respect to the same recommendation to confirm that we don't take any decisions or that we don't confirm any agreement in one single meeting. And between those meetings, as you will have seen, we first publish high-level summaries of the key findings to allow for refinements and further discussions on the list before then sending through a document with more stable language, which is going to serve as instructions for those that are going to implement our recommendation at a later stage. So the changes that we've made with respect to board member removal liability mitigation, you find summarized at the beginning of the document. So basically, we are seeking to mitigate the risk of litigation in case of board removal, and one of the options to get that done is to have the board members sign pre-service letters before they're being seated. We will move to the respective paragraph in the recommendation momentarily, and that's actually going to be paragraph 39, which has been offered by our lawyers. And after the meeting, we've kindly been notified by Cavus that we did not speak to two recommendations that have been made by the board, one of which relates to offering a rationale for why the board member is to be dismissed. So we've included that, and we've suggested language based on the conversation that was held on the list. And the second aspect was that the board asked us to put something in writing, which we think should go without saying, and that is that the director in question should be contacted before all of this process is started. I think that's something that you would do out of courtesy anyway, to give the director a heads up, where possible, smoothen out the issues there are, so that hopefully there will never be the need for the escalation process to remove a director. Bruce's hand is up, so before we move to paragraph 39 in this document and then paragraph 42, if I'm not mistaken, let's hear Bruce's view.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas. We had a board informational call earlier today, probably about 7 or 8 hours ago, and we did talk through some of these topics. I think one thing is perhaps to provide a little bit of clarity, because I noticed that Alan Greenberg sent a note to the list saying, would it be sufficient for the written rationale just to say that the particular advisory committee felt that their board members' values, et cetera, weren't aligned with their values or whatever it was. Our response to that is yes. Really, we're basically saying whatever you believe the rationale is that you're going to use to convince the other parts of the community that you think it's justified to remove the board director, that's what should go in the written rationale. So if you just say you don't like the board member because they're rude, or you don't like the board member because they seem to always vote against that particular advisory committee's interests, then that's the reason that you want to give. So the rationale is really just a case of documenting in writing so that the affected board director or board can respond to the concern. But the content of that is entirely up to the SO and AC that initiates the process.
Thanks very much, Bruce. That's very helpful. And again, thanks to the board for turning around feedback to our refined recommendations so swiftly. So this is very helpful. I understand that you only spoke to this.
Sure. Yeah, so if I can just follow up just on another point. So your first point is we're not requiring cause, so to speak, using that legal term. Basically, the written rationale is the rationale that the SOAC believes as their reason for why they want to move the board director, and we're putting no restrictions on, you know, their ability to state their rationale. In terms of a pre-service letter, I think the board is comfortable with the notion that a pre-service letter might confirm or agree that should the relevant process come up with a decision that board member be removed, that the board member agrees to go. So, you know, we can certainly incorporate in the pre-service letter that the board member's not going to try and hang on if a legitimate decision is made. What the board was uncomfortable doing was, as an individual board director, waiving rights for defamation, et cetera. A process where the board member steps down based on the outcome of the process, but wasn't going to sort of indemnify people to say anything they like about the board member.
Thanks very much, Bruce. And in fact, I was about to thank you for your feedback on this first aspect and invite you to comment on the other aspects of our refinements as well, which you just did. So thank you for that. I think there are we've given thought to the points that you mentioned, so I will speak in a moment to the issue that you've raised with respect to the waiver. And that is that I think it was you who mentioned that it would not be appropriate for the to-be-dismissed board member to waive any claims in case there's defamatory content that's voiced by SOAC leaders or other individuals in the community. So just to illustrate this, let's say somebody says that Bruce needs to go because he's a fraudster or a murderer, then certainly you should not be without any possibility to seek legal relief. we've run this by our lawyers, and in the covering note to the updated recommendation 4, which was possibly not in your inbox when you did convene your board meeting, we included feedback from our lawyers that says that in cases where let me just dig it out for you. As to the extreme example you pose regarding defamation, the waiver that we're suggesting is unlikely to be viewed as absolute. A court would likely view it through a lens of equity in relation to the specific set of facts presented. Outrageous facts that involve international known falsehoods may lead to a court not recognizing the waiver was against public policy. So this is, I think, that missing bit that you're looking for. So in the first place, we would have waivers as requested by some commenters in order to make sure that not in each and every instance where criticism is being brought up against the director, the person bringing up the criticism is in danger of being sued by the departing director. But on the other hand, we would have a corrective safety net, let's say, for the director in question, so that in case the OAC leader just brings forward wrong accusations or any accusations that are missing a fact base, that the director would still be able to seek legal protection. There are two hands raised. I would really like us to look at the concrete wording suggested by the lawyers before we open it up for discussion. But I trust that the commenters both want to speak to this very topic that I just wrote our legal advisor's note on. And since that is not explicitly covered in the updated report, let's hear Alan, and should Bruce wish to speak to this point as well, let's hear Bruce as well. Alan.
Thank you. I just like clarification. I think Bruce said the board was uncomfortable with both waiving and indemnifying. The indemnifying was not captured in the notes. I wanted to make sure that it is what he said or not.
That is correct. Yeah, we're uncomfortable with the indemnification or waiver. If we're talking about a pre-service letter, we are comfortable with agreeing to agreeing to comply with the instruction, if you like, from the empowered community. So if the empowered community goes through its process and wishes to remove a board director, we will commit in writing to comply with that request.
Thank
Alan,
you.
Was that the
I'll wait till the actual discussion before I raise any issues. I just wanted a clarification. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks, Bruce, for the clarification. Let's now please jointly look at paragraph 39 of the document that was circulated several hours ago. And since it's only a little bit of text, and since possibly not all of you had the opportunity to read through it, I will just read it out for you. As a condition to being nominated by an AC, an SO, or the nominating committee, and seated on the board, each director nominee shall be required to sign an irrevocable letter agreement that, first, expresses a contractual commitment that, one, acknowledges that the nominating AC or SO, or for directors appointed by the nominating committee, the empowered community has the right to remove the director from service at any time or for any reason through the process set out in the bylaws as described below. Two, confirms that the service as a director process does not establish any employment or other relationship to ICANN. The empowered community, the ACs, the SOs, or the nominating committee, or the agents of any of them that provide any due process rights related to the termination of service as a director other than those specified in the bylaws, and three, waives any and all claims against and releases from all liability ICANN, the empowered community, the ACs, the SOs, the nominating committee, and all of their agents, and any other individuals participating in the removal process arising from or in connection with the removal process. Second, provides a conditional irrevocable resignation from the board that is automatically effective upon final determination of removal through the individual director removal process or the full board recall process upon communication of such decision to the board as set forth below. In addition, ICANN shall indemnify and advance expenses of defending against any claim against the empowered community, the ACs, the SOs, the nominating committee, or the agents of any of them for their good faith actions in seeking removal of a director or the full board. So I would like to open it up for discussion on that that point. But maybe before we do so, let's also add the other few lines that we've added. And that is, if you scroll further down to the next page in paragraph 41, so we've specified there that a petition must be supported by a comprehensive and written rationale stating the reasons why removal is sought. So we are not using the term fulsome, which has caused some debate, but we've just asked for comprehensive and written rationale. And second addition in that same paragraph is that prior to completion of the petition phase, the affected director and the chair of the board, or the vice chair if appropriate, is invited to a dialogue, which also includes the individuals bringing the petition and the chair of the SOAC where the petition is under consideration. The purpose of the dialogue is to gain a full understanding of the issues leading to the petition and consider if there are any other ways to address the concerns. So those are the two additional points that we have included post-meeting, and I see Alan's hand is up, so Alan, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Two quick points. In light of Bruce's comments on, you know, that if we say we don't like the color of the director's hair or whatever, and that's satisfactory if that's the reason, I'm not sure the word comprehensive is appropriate here. I'm not going to die on my sword on it, but I think that's overkill in light of what has been said so far. And I just want a clarification. Is this the right time to talk about? Are we just talking about the words written, or are we talking about the board's reaction?
Not sure I'm clear on the last aspect you mentioned.
The words here in paragraph 39 talk about both the waiver and indemnification. Bruce has said the board is not comfortable with that. Is this the right time to talk about that or not?
Please do. But before you continue on that point, if it's just the color of the hair of the director to be removed, then a statement speaking to the color of the hair would be comprehensive. But I'm not...
All right. As I said, I'm not dying on my sword on it.
Let's all try to stay alive on that point.
All right. It just sounds like overkill, but I take your point. The ALAC was one of the groups that raised, maybe we were the only one, I don't think so, though, that raised the issue of indemnification and waiving rights or some combination of the two. Without either, I really don't see how anyone would ever dare to try to remove a director. And it makes the whole power rather impotent. Thank you.
Can I understand that, Alan? I'm really struggling with that, to be honest.
Okay. If there's the threat against me personally as chair of the ALAC for raising the issue on behalf of the ALAC that our director has done something that we think is improper or whatever, and the director now has the ability of saying, hey, because you've made that accusation in public, I can no longer ever get a job again, and I'm going to seek restitution. That puts the group in a position where they're not likely to take any chances like that when their personal liability might be at stake.
Right, it's
not just the AC or SO. It's the people who are saying the words.
Right, okay.
So we have Cavus's hand up. Cavus?
Yes, a small point on the last part. I suggest that we replace if appropriate by if requested, because I don't understand who will decide whether it is appropriate or not to invite the board. And second, invited has different connotation. I suggest that we replace is by will be invited. So the text should read that if requested, will be invited. So the board in question may request to be invited, and that will be done. So appropriation is not correct yet, if appropriate, because we put a decision under whom? Who will decide that? So we have to slightly modify this last portion. Thank you.
Thanks, Kaboos. I think that the inclusion of if so requested, I think Kaboos is saying that board participation, if so requested by the affected director or the petitioning SOAC, right?
Yes, right. Yes.
So let's please put that point in the notes section. I think that's useful feedback. And for those who are against the inclusion of that addition, please do speak up. Otherwise, I hope that this is uncontroversial. I see Greg's hand is up. Greg.
I'm actually going to go back to the point on the word comprehensive, which I think should be removed. I think it only creates the possibility of a challenge. If reasons are sufficient to convince other SOACs to go along and remove that director, that should be fine. I think it only creates the potential for mischief in challenging a rationale as somehow not being comprehensive. It would clearly be foolhardy for any SOAC to, you know, leave out the main reasons they were trying to remove a director, since they need to convince other SOACs to come along with them. And on the other hand, if they were able to convince the SOACs on whatever reasons they decided to put forward, that should be good enough. So I think this does us no good and potentially harm, and therefore I think it should be removed. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Greg, and I take your feedback as well as the feedback mentioned by others in the chat and orally as an encouragement to just remove the word comprehensive. You will see or you will remember that on the mailing list there was a discussion surrounding the word fulsome, which is why Mathieu ultimately suggests the word comprehensive as a replacement and basically a compromise position. But since individuals on this call don't seem to like it, and since Bruce has specified that a written rationale offering the reasons why director removal is sought should be sufficient, let's just strike it out. And let's just say a petition must be supported by a written rationale stating the reasons why removal is sought. And I would like those who are about to die in the ditch for either inclusion of comprehensive or fulsome to speak up. Otherwise, I would like to close that language on that specific aspect of paragraph 41 and move back to the waiver language. And I'm not sure whether the explanations given so far have been sufficient to shed enough light on the issue so that we can close it. But I think that we tried to find a balance between Alan's concern and the rightfully framed arguments that Bruce brought forward, that we must neither leave directors exposed to defamatory statements that are entirely unjustified, but at the same time, we should not leave the SO or AC leaders that might need to bring up concerns about a director publicly with the exposure to legal liability. And again, the reasoning behind what's been suggested with the assistance of our lawyer at the moment is that for claims that are within what's appropriate, i.e. we don't like the positions the director is taking, or the person is just not appropriately working on the board, should be okay. And in that scenario, I think it will be hard to agree to reason why, for those cases, there shouldn't be any waiver, because in fact there shouldn't be any reason for the removed director to seek legal protection. And on the other hand, where the allegations against the director cross the border of being defamation, then the waiver wouldn't be valid anyway, according to our lawyer's assessment, and then the director in question could actually go to a court and try to get that rectified or seek relief. Is that something that that we can settle on? Or are there any concerns remaining with language that has now been suggested? Keith is confirming his support, so is Izumi. Thank you for that. I understand that our language has not been sent to the list when the board convened, so I hope that this additional information is good enough to address the board's concerns. Greg, I think I haven't seen your hand lower since you last spoke, so I trust that it was an old hand. Caboose has raised his hand, and just to ensure that we don't get any friction and that we can close this matter today, I would like one of the board representatives to confirm that they're okay with the suggested way forward. But before we do so, let's hear Caboose.
Yes, Thomas, I put two times in the chat that before ending the second reading, please ask once again the board member whether all the concerns that they have referred to has been met, because I don't want after the second reading, still they come back with a new concern. Thank you.
Thanks, Kavut, and you will have noted that before inviting you to speak, I have invited the board to do exactly that. So thanks for the reminder. I'm not sure whether Bruce or Steve or any other board member on this call would like to respond.
Well, I think we're not yet agreeing to that proposal that there is a waiver. I think that's our position at the moment, that we certainly at an individual director level through a service letter, the position is that the individual director would not provide a waiver. Now, is there a possibility for the organisation to provide some sort of indemnity? That's something that we could research further and consider the legal advice that you've received. But that's our position, as I had stated earlier in the call.
Okay, so Bruce, I understand that you will take this back to the board. Also trust that that the information that we've offered might be sufficient to also address the concerns that you've raised. Again, the intention is not to leave the directors entirely unprotected, but in normal cases, let's say, there shouldn't be the reason to have a scenario where, let's say, the SO and AC leaders are silenced because they are afraid that they are taken to court if only they mention anything negative about the about a director in question. Can I also?
Thomas, if I can just say, what I think is fairly is unlikely that the board would change its position on is the idea that individual board members are going to give that waiver. The bit that I think we can investigate further is that last paragraph. So the last paragraph says that, and I'm looking at paragraph 39, the text that I can see on the screen in Adobe Chat says that ICANN shall indemnify and advance expenses of defending any claim against the empowered community the ACs, the SOs, the nominating committee, or the agents for their good faith actions in seeking removal of a director. That is something I will ask our legal team to investigate further if there's a way of giving that indemnity. Some of the concerns that were raised in our discussion today was that certainly when it comes to individual members, you know, they may have commercial incentives to take action against a particular director. There may be a whole raft of reasons why you know, it would be inappropriate to have sort of an open indemnity. But to the extent that something can be crafted there, and maybe the Rosemary and her colleagues might have some ideas of how to limit that. But I think the principle, and I'm speaking only personally now, the principle is that, from my perspective, is that an officer of one of these SOs or ACs or nominating committee should be able to, in good faith, exercise the powers. And an indemnity, the question is, can we create such an indemnity? That's a question I will ask our legal team to investigate.
Thanks, Bruce. I think that is well understood. Last speaker on this topic is going to be Alan.
Thank you. I'll just point out that if we're using the term agent, and Bruce just used the term officers of the AC and SO, we're not going to have a really, to use the word, fulsome discussion. We're not going to have a spirited discussion with lots of contributions if the only people are identified are the chairs. So we're talking about a community forum with lots of people. At one point, we were even saying we're going to fly them somewhere so they can talk face-to-face. That's not going to happen if only the chairs are the ones who are indemnified. I'm just raising that flag. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. I think there is a little bit of work to be done on this, but I think that what I'm hearing is that there should be a balance between the community being able, or community representatives being able, to speak up and voice concerns, because otherwise the community power would never be invoked, and on the other hand, not let the director twist in the wind in case he or she is exposed to outrageous allegations. There is the we have two legal instruments at our fingertips, which is the waiver and indemnification, and I would suggest that we ask our lawyers to reach out to the ICANN legal team or Jones Day directly. Bruce, you said that you wanted to reach out to the legal team to conduct some analysis, and I think that, you know, we're all seeking to achieve the same results here, and since this is more a matter of legal wordsmithing and applying those two instruments appropriately, let's put them together and come up with a suggested language and way forward for us. So I think that we have exchanged the arguments that need to be exchanged in order to give guidance to that dialogue, and let's therefore not spend further time in this group, but bring back feedback from the legal teams if and when it is ready. So I hope that this is an acceptable way forward for everyone. Thank you so much for this discussion, and for the next topic, if I'm not mistaken, I'm going to hand over to Mathieu.
Thank you, Thomas. This is Mathieu Veil speaking, and hello, everyone. So the next second reading item on our agenda is Workstream 2, recommendation number 12. We're going to upload the document that was circulated after last week's call. A quick reminder, we had clarified that in the interim bylaw article that we are recommending, there was some confusion, but the intent was that Workstream 2 recommendation be considered by the ICANN board with exactly the same type of rules as Workstream 1. We had also reminded that deliberations of Workstream 2 would follow the same process as the current deliberations, including the fact that they would be open to all, and that in terms of time frame, we would certainly use target dates, but that hard deadlines would not be appropriate or even helpful. And we had also agreed that enhancing ombudsman role and function would be confirmed as a Workstream 2 item. Some further description will be provided shortly. So to start off with this item, since Bruce confirmed that there has been an informational call from the board very recently, maybe I can turn to you, Bruce, for confirmation that these clarifications do address the concerns raised by the ICANN board in its latest comment, or if there's anything outstanding.
Matthew, this is in relation to the Workstream 2, is that correct?
Correct. Workstream 2, Recommendation 12.
Okay. The discussion we had on that was really focused on paragraph 5, and we noticed there's been a change in the sentence that says the bylaw would task the group with creating further enhancements to ICANN's accountability. The words that have been struck say including but not limited to, and the replacement words were related to. I think the board's preference there would be that the replacement word be limited to rather than related to. We felt related to could be, you know, pretty much given those topics are fairly broad already, that you could probably create another 100,000 topics that are related to them in some way. We wanted to keep it limited to that set of issues because that's really a set of issues where we're going to provide staffing and legal counsel and other resources, and we want to be able to make sure that we can provide those resources to that set of issues. It's also recognising that there is an ATRT review process, so new topics can always be added in a regular review cycle. So every 3 to 5 years, the accountability is reviewed, and that work would kick off further pieces of work to do. So it's not constraining anything into the future, but we felt that we needed to have a clear scope, if you like, for Workstream 2 that's got a clear set of issues, and those issues we would provide staffing and resources to try and complete those issues. And then the only other comment we were concerned about, and I'm not sure where the relevant paragraph is, but I gather there's a paragraph that talks about trying to put a date in the bylaws for when the Workstream 2 must be completed. Is that correct?
No, the intent is not to have a date in the bylaws. Is there only use target dates for our internal, I mean, for the
okay,
management
good.
Of the
yeah,
process, but the, that's all.
Yeah, so there was a concern that there was some date. I think it might be paragraph 3, actually, because it says intended that the Workstream 2 are published for comments by the end of 2016. Yeah, so as long as that's not something that we're trying to put in the bylaws, I think the only final comment we had was that we just wanted to have a clear set of Workstream 2 issues that would be resourced.
Thanks, Bruce. Just a question for clarification. Are you implying that for the rest of the concerns of the board about the way the Workstream 2 recommendation were to be considered and everything, your absence of comment means that it's been correctly addressed? I'm just
yes.
trying to
yeah,
make that,
the, that, that. That is correct. The rest of the changes in paragraph 5, we believe, address that concern. So the only outstanding item for us was that we wanted to have a constrained list of Workstream 2 issues to resource rather than an open-ended list that's in the bylaws themselves. But still remember that the community can work on any issue they want, and then it's just a question of them doing their own resourcing, I suppose. There's nothing stopping people to getting together and looking at something. But we also have the ATRT2 process, the review process for the accountability and transparency, which is an ongoing process. So new issues can always be added.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce. I think my understanding from the board feedback is that the only outstanding point of discussion is the wording the wording regarding the list of issues for Workstream 2, whether it's related to a number of topics or limited to, and probably before going to an extra item after that, just would like to check whether there's any specific concern to limited to in the list of issues. I think that was the intent, but I want to check there's no objection to that. Okay, so we'll take that on for the moment. Only other significant concern that we've received was from the public expert group advisors, the PEG advisors, a discussion that was started earlier. They did reinforce their advice that we strengthen diversity as part of Workstream 2 because it's perceived to be absolutely critical to capture the diversity of views across the globe on global public interest. So there's a recommendation from them to strengthen this aspect of the Workstream 2 proposal, which I think could be agreed on quite easily. And we have to also clarify the ombudsman section. Becky and Avery were identified as volunteers to provide this, but I don't think it's a blocking issue at this point. I see Matthew's notes on the chat, who suggests to add that further items beyond those in Workstream 2 can be accommodated through regular review cycles. I think it's a very good suggestion for clarification. And I am seeing no hand. Maybe my AC room is stuck, but it's a good sign, which means that I think we can consider this second reading on recommendation 12 successful. And with the small changes that we've discussed, we would probably be able to move that to the finalization stage. And before that, Sebastian's hand is raised.
Yes, thank you, Mathieu. Hope you can hear me well.
Yes.
Just to be sure what Bruce said, he said that if there are other topics, it will be, we will be able to raise it within the regular reviews. But I'm not sure that currently the ATRT is so open to any issue that the community would like to raise. And I am not sure that it's a little bit of where we will do that. And maybe we need to change something in the bylaw accompanying the ATRT. But I just want to be sure that if any new issue arises, we are not able to do it for Workstream 2, then it will be accommodated in the review teams. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. And Avery is noting in the chat that we, in the ATRT system being brought back to the bylaws, I think we have accommodated for that possibility to review any accountability issue. We can certainly double check that because we are somehow amending the ATRT system already. Bruce, you're next in line.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. One thing I also just wanted to point out, it's just kind of a restatement of something that we had said earlier, but we also wanted the flexibility if the chartering organisations wanted to do this. This is more kind of bylaw drafting, I guess, but you know, there'd be the ability for the chartering organisations to spin off separate cross-community working groups if they wished, so that they wouldn't be constrained by the bylaws in that area. Because I see there's quite big topics. There's diversity, SO accountability, transparency, human rights, jurisdiction, ICANN ombudsman. Those are quite diverse topics. And we just wanted to give scope, if the supporting organisation or chartering organisations wished, that they could create those as separate cross-community working groups if they wish to. But meeting all the same requirements as the current one, in other words, open participation, etc.
Thank you very much, Bruce. That's very helpful. And I noted that you pasted your board comment in the chat, and we will capture it in the notes as well. It's extremely helpful. And with that, I believe we can consider that our second reading has been very positive here. Thank you to the ICANN board for being very reactive to our comments. It's very helpful. Yes?
Sorry, Malcolm Hattie, I'm on audio only, apologies. I'd like to thank Bruce for that last particular suggestion, the idea that SOA and NECs can spin off specific targeted CCWGs, and ask, could that also include new issues that the SOs and ACs identify that have not been identified in this report? I'm concerned that the limitation of so-called Workstream 2 doesn't even include all the things that we'd previously identified in this CCWG at an earlier stage in the process, let alone new things that might be identified. But if SOA and ACs can spin off new CCWGs to address those specifically at a later stage, that would satisfy me. So could I have that clarification?
I think we can definitely add this as a clarification with Matthew Shear's suggestion.
Thank you.
Good. So with that, we're now moving to our next agenda item, and I'm turning to my co-chair, Liam. Leon, if you're speaking, we cannot hear you yet. I think we have lost Leon at the moment, so I will do a short introduction, and he will be joining shortly. So the next agenda item is the first reading. It's on related to recommendation number 7 on strengthening the IRP, the independent review process. Most of the comments we've received are actually related to the scope of the IRP. And that's the point.
I am back, Matthew.
Okay. I turn over to you, Leon, for the remaining of the introduction.
Thank you very much. I am sorry for the call being dropped. And as Matthew was saying, we will now be reviewing recommendation 7. This would be the first reading for the recommendation. And we have had a couple of comments from different commenters, of course. And we have two key discussion points for this recommendation, the first being the discussion on comments related to the scope of the IRP, which, of course, has some other related topics as the possible inclusion of the PTI actions or inactions as a matter of the scope in the IRP and the exclusion of the protocol and parameter decisions as per requested by the IAB comment, the expert panel decisions, which is a concern raised by the board that we will be going into details in a minute, and then the DIDP decisions, which is also a board concern, which will be also analyzed in a couple of minutes. Then the second key discussion point would be to discuss how to best transfer or incorporate the different comments that we received in regard to suggestions to the implementation and the details for implementation and of the oversight group on the IRP. So the first key discussion point is the scope of the IRP, and the first subtopic for discussion here would be to include the PTI actions or inactions as a matter that could be challenged by an IRP. So I would like to, of course, open the floor for comments as to whether the group considers feasible to actually include PTI actions or inactions as a matter of an IRP. So I see the first in the queue is Becky Burr. Becky, could you please take the floor?
Yeah, thanks. I have a sort of broader comment. I think that with respect to making very specific the inclusion of PTI actions or inactions as it's a CWG requirement, it doesn't seem to me to be very controversial. Likewise, the exclusion of protocol parameter decisions per the IAB comment likewise seems not controversial and consistent with the manner in which we have handled the numbers-related issues. So I think that those two recommendations or suggestions are really by way of clarification, and they're not particularly controversial. I would support them. So that's all I have to say on those two things.
Thank you very much, Becky. So I see no other hands raised, so I would now call for any objections to actually modify our report in a way that we include PTI actions or inactions as clarifying item for IRP, and of course to also exclude the protocol and parameters decisions as per the IAB comments. And since the feedback that we have received from Becky, which is the pen holder for the IRP, is that this wouldn't seem to be controversial. I would just like to call for any objections on this, and I know Alan Rubber's hand is up. Alan, could you please take the floor?
Yeah, thank you. I'm not objecting, nor do I think it's controversial. The question is, do we have outcomes that go along with it? Because at this point, the outcomes of an IRP are to say I can't violate its bylaws. I'm not sure PTI action or inaction falls into that category. So whatever we put within the purview of the IRP, we need to make sure that there are results that it can generate that address that whatever the thing is it's considering. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Next on the queue, I have Jordan.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, Jordan.
Hi. Thanks, all. It's Jordan Carter, .nz here. Just to slightly query what Alan just said, the PTI structure will be set out in fundamental bylaws as per the requirement of the CWG. And so I think that it's reasonable for there to be an IRP framework to make sure that it isn't breaching those fundamental bylaws and any other bylaws that are in place around it. So if that doesn't happen here, it needs to happen somewhere else. So I think the CWG's requirement is reasonable there. Thanks.
Thanks, Jordan. And I note that Becky is adjusting as per reply to Alan's comment, I guess, that the IRP oversight team could be charged with actually developing those outcomes. So I guess that goes in line also with key discussion point number two, and we would be adding that to the report. And next on the queue, I have Kavus. Kavus, could you please take the floor?
Yes, you know, and I see some inconsistencies for such inclusion. PTI is affiliate of ICANN, a subcontractor of ICANN, and now any action or inaction of PTI subcontractor of ICANN may lead at the end that ICANN has violated the bylaw. I don't see any consistency and coherence with that. So I have some doubt about that inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavus. Alan, you're next.
Thank you. I was going to say something similar. I'm not at all convinced that the result is a violation of ICANN's bylaws because PTI is a creature of the bylaws. And I'm happy with the implementation team doing it. I just believe that in our proposal, we need to say a possible outcome of the IRP is a violation, is pointing out a violation of ICANN's bylaws, or in the case of a PTI action or inaction, appropriate remedial action. Just some words that give the implementation team the right to do that. That's all.
Thanks, Alan. Next on the queue, I have Martin Boyle. Martin?
Thanks, Leon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thanks. Yes, it's following up in a similar sort of vein, that ICANN's responsibility to PTI is to ensure that PTI carry out what they are contracted to do from ICANN. And applying something directly to PTI because it is a subsidiary, an affiliate of ICANN, leaves me sort of uncertain as to what would happen should there be subsequently separation and a new body, new organization starts carrying out the role of PTI under contract to ICANN. At the moment, the wording here seems to me to be a little bit specific to just PTI, and we cannot guarantee that PTI will be with us forever. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Martin. So I note that Matthew is pointing that shouldn't we be talking about extending the standard of review to include the PTI in the bylaws or the rules? And what I would suggest to move forward on these two points, which are including the PTI actions or inactions and excluding the protocol parameters decisions, what I would be suggesting as a way forward is to make a proposal for amending our report that would take into account the comments that have been raised in this call by several of you, by Alan, Caboose, Martin, etc. And having this in mind, there would be a new wording that would try to address both issues, points A, B, and, of course, the comments related to those points in this call. Would there be any objection to moving forward in the suggested way? Okay, so I see no objection, and then the way forward would be to modify this and then go back to the list, circulate these modifications, and, of course, continue discussion in the second reading. Then, as for points C and D, which are the extra panel decisions, we have some concerns raised by the board in their comments, and these more specifically refer to the appeals mechanisms for such process and the specific expert panels that should be part addressed within the PDP or program. So I would like to listen from some board members about a little bit more about this concern. And I know that Becky Burr's hand is up. Becky, could you please take the floor?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we can go, you know, this is just a decision that we have to make within the group, and we've gone back and forth on it. Right now, you know, action by the expert decision panel that essentially amounts to, you know, an action in violation of ICANN's bylaws, and that is not corrected by the board, would be covered by the independent review process. So even if we took out the notion that the IRP would have some responsibility for reconciling conflicting decisions among the expert panels, we still would retain some check with respect to those expert panels to the extent that the ICANN board didn't exercise its authority to correct decisions that put ICANN in contrary or crosswise with its bylaws. So I just want to make sure that people understand that taking out the expert panel decisions reconciliation does not mean that there is no accountability for those decisions. And I would note that some people have pointed out on the list, and I think it's a reasonable position, that we had specifically intended the IRP to be a constitutional court, a court of limited jurisdiction, and to some extent, a sort of generalized reconciliation role goes a bit beyond that.
Thank you very much, Becky. Next on the queue, I have Fawuz.
Yes, Leon, I have one comment about B, if you allow me. I have no problem with exclusion of protocol, but in your recommendation, or recommendation 7, in the report, third proposal of CCWG, we have mentioned that with respect to the CCWG stewardship decision for the country code, we say until country code, top-level domain, and others develop relevant appeal mechanism. But with respect to REAR and the IETF, no problem to exclude them. But who will develop any required appeal mechanism? There should be no appeal mechanism at all, or will not be here, but elsewhere would be, because we need to do the same treatment as we did for the revocations of the CCTLD. We exclude them from the appeal mechanism, but leave it to the CCTLD consultation with others to develop appropriate mechanism. But now we exclude ASO, when we exclude IETF, who will develop any required appeal mechanism? We should mention at least something in final proposal that until the time that we put XY, I don't know who, will develop the required appeal mechanism. This is the comment that I made for the recommendation many days ago. It was not conceded, but now we have to concede it. So no problem with the exclusion of IETF, no problem with the exclusion of ISO, but we have to mention until the time that the required appeal mechanism developed by, and we put it XYZ, I don't know who will develop that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavus. I note that after the comments in the chat box from Becky and Andrew Sullivan, I believe that both the ASO and the IETF already have appeals mechanism in place. So what I would suggest, this is a very important a comment that you've made, and I really appreciate you pointing to this need for clarification in our report. So what I would say is that we could add maybe some clarification language to note that these appeals mechanisms are already in place in the case of the ASO and the IETF, so they don't need to actually be developed anymore, and that would leave or provide more clarity to what we are trying to reflect in our report. Thanks, Kaboos. Next on the queue, I have Bruce Tonkin.
Thank you, Leon. I just wanted to just flesh out some of Becky's comments a little bit further regarding expert panels and bylaws. If we look at the new GTLD process, and we just take a particular example where some decisions have been contentious, and that might be the decision on whether something is confusingly similar or not, I would think that the rules and the process that have been set up in the policy would be what's subject to whether it's consistent with the bylaws or not. Other than that, the expert panel has really chosen to develop an opinion on whether something is confusingly similar or not. I don't think that that itself is a violation of the bylaws. What I think we need in that situation, this is where the board was leaning, was that we need to design appeal processes within those expert decision panels. So as part of the new GTLD process, you might say, well, you have an expert panel and they decide whether something is confusingly similar, but there's an appeal mechanism to a bigger group of experts, for example, if there seems to be reasonable grounds that the first expert didn't take everything into account, for example. So I just wanted to sort of separate out that where the bylaws, I think, would be appealed is when you're actually setting up the panels in the first place and setting up their scope and what they can decide on. But an appeal, most of what we hear in the reconsideration process is people not disputing the grounds by which we are deciding, because it's part of the new GTLD policy. They just basically have a different opinion, and they want the board to override the opinion of the experts. And I don't think that's what the IOP should be used for.
Thank you very much, Bruce. So the other
hand up.
Subtopic. Is that Malcolm?
Yes, it is. Thank you. I'd agree with Bruce's point. The IRP is not there to challenge the opinion of the experts, but it should still be able to challenge the experts' decisions where the experts' decisions were inconsistent with the bylaws. So, for example, we have a fundamental commitment that ICANN should always act in implementing its policies in a way that is, and I'm quoting here from memory, but I think it's fair, neutral, objective, and not self-interested. Now, I think that if the experts were found to have acted in a way, or were claimed to have acted in a way that was self-interested, that should be open to challenge. The mere difference of opinion as to whether or not something is confusingly similar, I agree, should be excluded from the scope of the IRP. But it is possible that the decision is fundamentally inconsistent with the fundamental commitments, and that should be within the scope of the IRP.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. And I know that Becky is pulling up chat box, as I think you're not in the Adobe Connect room. She's putting in the chat box that, although I think technically the challenge would be ICANN board's failure to ensure consistency with bylaws. And then she's putting it up, plus one, Malcolm, believe that's the case. So that's for you to know that Becky is acknowledging and actually replying to what you just said, Malcolm.
Thank you.
And also Bruce is putting in the chat box, fair enough. But if the experts were self-interested, I think it would be overturned by the reconsideration process, as it would not be operating consistent with the rules of the process. So I guess the IRP in that case would be to challenge the board's decision on that point. And Becky is saying that she thinks that Bruce and her are saying the same thing. Okay, so I think that while we do acknowledge that there might be some things that need refinement in this issue on expert panel decisions, I can't foresee a clear conclusion on this yet. But what I would suggest is that we also analyze the comments that have been raised during the call and put some clarifications in place in the report, and we'll circulate them in a version so that we can, of course, continue discussion in the list and hopefully have a final decision on the next reading on this item. So the conclusion would be to clarify, of course, the language that is in the report. Then the next subtopic would be the DIDP decisions, in which the board has raised the concern that having the IRP related to DIDP would be to actually be engaging the IRP in operational decisions. And the board is suggesting that instead of being subject to IRP, that DIDP should be subject to reconciliation process as opposed to IRPs. So I would like to open the floor for comments. And I see that Brett Schaffer is asking whether we're going to discuss point D, and that is precisely the point we are discussing, Brett. So if you want to do comments, this is the time for you to actually shoot. Anyone want to comment on this? So the issue is that the board is saying that the IDP decisions shouldn't be subject to IRPs, as far as I understand, but instead they should be subject to reconsideration process. Brett, you're next on the queue. Please take the floor.
Yes. I actually had a couple of comments based on a note I sent to the board earlier today. I just wanted to verify that it's the understanding that everybody, the chairs of everybody in the CCWG, that an appeals process through DIDP is available to any individual or anybody else that feels that they were harmed or would like to question or have a reconsideration, I suppose, of a decision to deny a request for information under DID policies. That's the first thing. Second, I would like to make sure that the nature of those appeals aren't limited just to whether the board or ICANN followed the bylaws or were in violation of its mission, that it could actually get to the substance of the denial itself. And I want to make sure that that is part of this process. I am interested in the board's discussion or suggestion that it go through the reconsideration process. But what I don't, I'm uncertain about, rather, is that that process is truly independent of ICANN itself, and that we, you know, if you're going to have a DIDP appeals process, that it should be absolutely independent in a true review of the decision itself in all its aspects, whether that's on the basis of being a frivolous request or whether it's based on proprietary information or whatever the justification that original denial in whole or in part might be. Thanks.
Thanks, Brett. So I note that there are some comments in the chat box, and I see Bruce hand this up, so I would go to Bruce first, and afterwards I would go into the comments in the chat box. So Bruce, could you please take the floor?
Sorry, I was on mute. So what we actually said in the board comments for the DIDP, the sentence we had in there was, for the DIDP, the Workstream 2 effort on DDIDP can and should consider if there is a more robust escalation path, for example, considering the refinements to the ombudsman role. And then it says, for conflicting decisions, an appeals process should be developed. So I think our position on this one, just picking up comments about the independence of reconsideration, generally reconsiderations on document appeals is independent of staff, so the board is looking at that, and it's separate from the staff member that might have made the decision to redact something. But in our discussions at a board level, we can also see that this might well be a role for the ombudsman as well. So that the ombudsman independently could be part of an appeals process in the DIDP process. so that the the ombudsman can look at the original document, look at the request, and see if the staff have acted appropriately. Our general position as a board is that all documents should be public, so that's really the ombudsman should be applying those broad tests that are in the DIDP process, and perhaps being the first point of appeal before it gets to a reconsideration process.
Thank you very much. Bruce, next on the queue, I have Caboose.
Yes. Once you dealt with the CIDP, I have another general question, and that is, in the board's comment on Recommendation 7, they mentioned that all operational issues should not be subject to IRP, should be subject to reconsideration, including the IDP, but there are other issues that the board differ. Have we addressed these issues in a general term, or we would not do that? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caboose. Next, I have, I don't know if that's an old camp, Bruce, or a new camp. And after that, I have Brett Schaffer. So, Bruce, if that is okay, I assume that that was an old hand. Brett, is that a new hand?
It is. I just would like to get answers to the questions that I asked, and or at least clarification that my understanding is correct. The three questions are accurately laid out in the feedback section over to the right. Thank you.
Okay, so appeals process available to all? The answer is, I believe, yes. The IRP is available to any affected party. Then the second question is the nature of the IDP limited to following bylaws, or can it go to substance? My understanding is that the IRP, the new IRP as it stands, would be looking not only into process but also into substance, as opposed to the regular regular IRP that we have today. So it
could overturn the decision then.
That is my understanding, but I could of course be mistaken, and I would like to maybe call on Becky to correct me if I'm wrong on this. Becky?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I was distracted.
Yes, of course. Brett, could you please repeat the question for Becky?
Sure, Becky. Thank you for answering my question here. One is that I wanted to make sure that the IRP process, as we've outlined here, would be able to address not just the question of whether a DIDP refusal was in violation of the bylaws or in conflict with the admission, but would actually go to the substance of the reason behind the denial in the first place. So if I can reach a determination that a DIDP request was frivolous or vexatious or whatever justification they had, would the IRP process be able to challenge that and overturn that decision on the substance of the decision itself, not just whether they're in violation of the bylaws?
So the language in the third draft report, I think, did contemplate that. But I understand the board comment to be saying is that those kinds of appeals should be actually limited to whatever the reason, whether the board said that the request was frivolous or whatever that reason was, the fact of the denial was a violation of the bylaws. So that is a somewhat narrower standard than we had initially proposed. I think that in the draft report, what we were talking about was essentially having an independent judiciary function for the substantive decision making with respect to that. I guess my question is, I don't have a problem saying yes, reconsideration is the first way, and yes, in work stream two, we're talking about reviewing this process and there should be some escalation provision. But in all kind of governance schemes that I'm aware of where there's essentially a freedom of information function as the DIDP functions, you usually have the ability to appeal to a, an independent judiciary for a substantive review of the decision. And here, I think what the board is urging is that that would be available only if there was a bylaws violation.
Thank you, Vicky. But I hope that answers your question. And
It answers the question, but I think that is a very limited application of this process, and it doesn't really go to the substance of what was intended in the first place, which was to provide a independent means for appealing DIDP decisions themselves rather than whether they are in violation of the bylaws. So I do have an ongoing concern about this. Thank you.
Thanks, Brett. And, let's continue discussing these concerns in the list, and let's see if we can...
Leon, can I just clarify Becky's comment?
Yes, of course, Bruce.
I don't think the board is closing the option of having some independent judiciary, to use your terminology, with respect to DIDP. In fact, I think we support that there should be some independent party that you can appeal to and that can make a decision or recommendation. I think what we're suggesting is let's not confuse the purpose of the IRP. The IRP itself is for violation of ICANN's bylaws or articles of incorporation. So we're developing a standing panel and processes around experts in that particular area. I think what we've suggested for DIDP is we're saying that these more operational processes need to have their own appeals mechanisms. And if the Workstream 2 decided that there should be some independent judiciary panel, whatever terminology you want to call it, then that's what Workstream 2 should recommend. I don't think we've got any objection to that.
Thanks, Bruce. So I guess that... yes, Malcolm?
Thank you. I would like to quickly address Cavusa's intervention as to the general issue of whether so-called operational things should be excluded from the scope of the IRP. I think that Bruce has just stated it quite correctly in that last comment, in that last sentence he said. The IRP exists to ensure that ICANN has always acted at all times in compliance with its bylaws. Merely labelling something as operational with intervention shouldn't exclude it from review under the IRP, and that includes the DIDP or anything else. Secondly, an IRP case itself may require access to documents, and I would think that would be part of the rules of procedure of the IRP to govern when that's available and how that's available. I would think that the IRP panel itself should have oversight of that process.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. I see Bruce's hand is up and Brett Schaffer's hand is up, but I believe that Bruce, that's an all hand. Is that correct? Yes. So next on the queue, I have Brett Schaffer.
Okay, this is very quick. I just think that it's important for us to try and find an independent process in the current draft rather than waiting for Workstream 2. The Workstream 2 was to review the DIDP process itself, not necessarily to kick the appeals process to the second string work stream. Thanks. And so if we could do include an effort to try and identify whatever independent review process that Bruce is saying that the board is interested in and insert that here, whether that is an ombudsman task or whether that's some other independent judiciary appeals process or what have you, I think we need to try and incorporate that into the current draft. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brett. And I think that this is a perfect link to move forward in the second key discussion point. because the second key discussion point is how to best transfer the comments and suggestions as implementation details for implementation for the implementation oversight group. So I guess that this last comment of yours binds perfect both subjects, and it would be best if we could clarify or add, as you said, that under Workstream 2 we should be actually identifying best ways to actually achieve this independence in the DIDP process. So we have received, as I said, some other comments in regard to implementation, and these comments relate to prioritization of pro bono representation program as part of the exercise, other working languages accepted, other than English, of course, appointment of independent support staff, training of panelists by ICANN and ICANN community, technical resources available to panelists, IRP and financial benefits available to all recognized organizational units at ICANN, an exception to looser pay for non-for-profit organizations, an early indication from panels on frivolous requests to save costs, a review of the IRP tool midterm, CEP proceedings open to public, and a review of the cooperative engagement process as part of Workstream 2. So these are the comments that we received and that we feel that should be subject of these implementation oversight group, and of course part of the work that the implementation oversight group would be dealing with would be to address many issues in Workstream 2. So at this point I would like to open the floor for comments or any feedback as to how these implementation oversight team would be carrying out their work.
Okay, hand up.
Yes, Malcolm.
These comments are all very valid and good suggestions, I think, but our report proposed that there should be an ongoing capability for the community to keep the IRP, the adequacy of the IRP process under review and prefer and make provision for its further evolution in the light of experience and with the support of the standing panel. So that's not just before transition and not just as Workstream 2, but on an ongoing basis. And I think that that is the group that should be taking up these comments rather than the IRP implementation team, which would have to do it immediately.
Thanks, Malcolm. I did lose a little bit of communication. My line cut a little bit. So would you mind repeating the last words that you said, please?
So the CCWG report proposes an ongoing team from the community that would work on these kinds of issues in the light of experience and with the support of the standing panel. So I believe that we've created a mechanism to address these comments, and we don't need to discuss them in the implementation team that would happen immediately.
Thanks, Malcolm, and your comments have been noted in the notes, and I think that the implementation overview team will actually be taking this into account. So are there any other comments in regard to how the different suggestions that were received in this public comment period should be passed on to the IOT for the next steps? Okay, I see no more comments on this. So I guess that the way forward for this would be to actually pass these comments to the IoT, and then the IoT would be reviewing and evaluating the different comments and provide a way forward to actually implement this or incorporate these comments into implementation phase. Okay, so with this, we have reached the break, the scheduled break in our call. We are 3 minutes ahead of time, so we're doing well. And that gives us a 10-minute break. And we will be reconvening at 15 minutes before the hour. That would give us a 30-minute break. So we will be reconvening at 15 minutes before the hour. And I would like to ask for the recording to pause. And we'll talk to each other in 13 minutes. Thank you.
Pretty what? Disgusting. why was doing that?
Hello, everyone. This is Machiavelli speaking. It is 15 to the hour, and we will start this call again. Is the recording back on?
Yes, the recording is back on.
Thank you very much. So I hope you all joined again. We are now on our agenda item number 5. Agenda item number 5 is recommendation 6 on human rights. And just to launch this discussion, and it's a first reading, so I will start with the brief summary of the comments we've received. This is what I will read is a quote from the summary provided by staff that you all have seen. What we've seen in the comments is that a majority of the responses submitted supported the adoption of this recommendation. However, there were concerns raised. Those concerns were on the one side that a significant number of respondents requested that the inclusion of human rights language into the bylaws be delayed until the proposed framework of interpretation was completed, or even only be considered as part of Workstream 2. And also several commenters suggested that human rights statements do not belong to the bylaws. So we've had a lot of support, but it was not unanimous support. We have reviewed these comments in details, and the key discussion points that we're suggesting to have in this first reading are, number one, the discussion about the proposal that was part of the recommendation 6 to have a one-year deadline to develop the framework of interpretation. We would like to discuss this in light with our previous discussion regarding the need for timelines and deadlines, in the report. I think we should have this quick discussion. And then, obviously, the most substantial discussion, but it's more of a process discussion at this point, is regarding the concerns received about keeping the bylaw as part of Workstream 1 or moving into Workstream 2. And that's a very substantial type of discussion. it's useful to recall at this point that we have certified a request to our lawyers in order to get an assessment whether the inclusion of these bylaws as proposed in the third draft would increase the risk of ICANN being exposed to legal claims or even lawsuits vis-à-vis the current situation, and if so, how such risk could be mitigated. This request has been certified very recently. We expect some feedback in the next few days, certainly in time for the second reading. But the indications we are getting from our lawyers are consistent with the previous discussions where the level of risk did not seem to increase that much. But obviously that is pending confirmation. To kickstart this, before moving to this substantial discussion, I'd like to first check with the group whether discussion item number one, there would be any objection to aligning our approach in terms of deadlines with that with the one we discussed last week on Workstream 2, which is that target dates are useful, but we should avoid hard deadlines, which might have a counterproductive effect in developing further work. Brett, you have a comment on this?
Just a quick clarification. I want to make sure that before we proceed into this full discussion that the board doesn't have any problems with the human rights language as laid out in Annex 12 in the Workstream 2. Because
can I just
put them together.
Happy to take that question once we get into the substantial discussion of Workstream 1, Workstream 2. What I'm trying to see here is whether we can just, before that, close the hopefully easier item about hard deadline versus target dates, which was a concern raised by ALAC, I believe, in their comment in the comment we've received from ALAC on the third report. Niels, you're next.
Perhaps it's better to have Alan go first because he might be better to explain his exact comment. So I'll go after Alan if that's okay.
Oh, that's perfectly okay. Thank you very much, Niels. Alan?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to make one qualification. We didn't say it was too aggressive. We said there it was not prudent to put a hard deadline in the bylaws where if for whatever reason, whether it was too aggressive or, you know, there's a hurricane that stops us from doing work, we end up being in violation of our bylaws. So the net result is the same, and I'm happy if we put something softer in, but I just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan, and sorry for the mischaracterization. Niels.
This sounds completely okay to me, but I think that the discussions under point two might then also in retro effect affect point one, but let's first finish point one for now and then go to point two. I think that's where the real discussion is at.
Indeed. And so with no further hand in the queue, I would consider the proposed approach to be reasonable at this point until we have further discussion in item number two. Cavus? Cavus, if you're speaking, we cannot hear you at this point. Cavus, your line may be muted. Can we double-check that Cavus line is open? I see Brenda confirming that Cavus line is open. Okay, in seeing that we have some technical issues with Cavus, we will make sure we fix this quickly and give Cavus the floor as soon as he gets back online. Meanwhile, moving to item number two, I think we've received concern from the ICANN board on this matter, so it would be extremely helpful if Bruce or someone from the ICANN board could elaborate a little bit on the concerns regarding the inclusion of the broad human rights language. Oh, Cavus, you're back.
Okay. Can I talk, please?
Yes, go ahead, Cavus.
Okay. My question was simple. ICANN board mentioned that reference to the to the human rights should be postponed until the framework of interpretation is ready. Do they agree that we refer to the human right in a very high level, as it was discussed by Leon in many, many hours of the meeting, or ICANN board does not want to have any reference at all to the human right under work stream 1? That was my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus, and it's very good that you are managed to get back in just before I was about to turn to Bruce. Because that's also clarifying part of the question about the concern from the board, which we'd like to hear the make sure we have clarity on the rationale, but also this question that you're raising, Cavus, and that Brett was raising earlier about whether the board is only concerned about the timing or only about or also about the wording of the proposed bylaw change. I don't know, Bruce, if you are online and can respond?
I am. It's probably not an area that I'm especially expert in, but what do you mean by timing? Sorry, Matthew?
We understand the concern from the board that the suggestion from the board to defer adoption of this bylaw article until Workstream 2 and the framework of interpretation is completed. Does that imply that the board is comfortable with the way the bylaw article is currently written? Or is there also an issue with the way it's written at this point?
I think a broader issue, as I understand it, is basically we didn't want a bylaw provision that said we were doing something with human rights without actually explaining how they relate to ICANN. So I think it does relate to your timing question, Matthew. Our view was that we should first do the work on what our framework should be for interpreting human rights in the context of ICANN's mission as a work item, and then once that's done, we incorporate that in the bylaws. I gather the potential solution around that is the bylaws doesn't come into effect or something until that is done. Is that what you mean by timing?
Yeah, I think you're answering somehow the question that was raised. I noticed that Marcus Kummer raised his hand, and that might be an elaboration on the board's position on this. Marcus, welcome.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me? I'm not sure whether my audio works. It seems to work.
It works pretty well. Thank you, Marcus.
Well, I was on a chat with Niels, and we actually had a brief discussion whether the email Thomas had sent out with the lawyer's opinion would convince the board that the perceived risks are not really that big. But in my opinion, there are essentially two different views, and the board makes fairly detailed comments on the perceived risks. And I think in order to mitigate this perception, these comments should be addressed more in detail. And there were more or less on two pages on the board's reaction, the board's paper as a reaction to the CCWG. And that, I think, would need a more detailed discussion. But at a very high level, I think we have, and you outlined these options quite nicely. We have three options and key discussion items, and that's 2A, 2B, and 2C. So deferring it towards Stream 2, I think, would meet the board's concerns, but I also understand that would have a would be objected by many, as so much work has already been invested. And just looking at it without having been able to discuss it with the board, the proposal on the 2C would seem a reasonable compromise, that is to have a proviso, okay, this is a moving target, but it will not enter into force only after the framework of interpretation has been worked out. So that would be, to me, it seems to be a reasonable safeguard. But as I said, again, a word of caution, we have not discussed this with the board. And the question whether the risks are there or not, I think, would need a more detailed discussion. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not familiar with U.S. law, but I do know litigation is a serious issue in the U.S., and I think that would need to be discussed by legal specialists who have more insight. Again, 2C could be a reasonable way out. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Marcus, confirming this approach. From Bruce and Mark's comment, my understanding is that the concern is as much on the number of potential litigations which might divert ICANN resources to precise only just defend ICANN's views, rather than just the level of risk of being found in breach of the particular bylaw change. That's, I think, an important point to have in mind. Now we should move definitely to the discussion on this, keeping in mind it's a first reading, and as noted by Bruce in the chat, it's the document here has not been considered by the board, so we're just at the stage of initial discussions. And Niels, please take the floor now.
Thank you very much for this, for the floor, Mathieu. I would like to respond to Marcus and Bruce, and I would like to thank the board very much for their comment. On the other hand, I was quite surprised by the board after the long work considerations and discussions that we had in working party four. And so I've been looking at the concerns raised by the board, and I have not been able to find in the board's comments a legal justification or an example for that concern. So I went back to the legal advice we, as Article 19, had been looking at by our own lawyers, but also by the lawyers of the Institute for Human Rights and Business, and there we found out that in a lot of companies or organizations that have made human rights commitments, such as banks, such as Nestle, such as Nike, we have not seen an avalanche of lawsuits, and actually that a commitment to CSR and sustainability policy claims and human rights is not leading to extra vulnerabilities and risks. And this is now again confirmed by the CCWG lawyers. So I would be really grateful if the board would come up with a legal analysis from where their concerns would come from. Because right now, I really do not see where these concerns come from. And if they could substantiate that, I would be really happy to further engage in this discussion. Then I had some very short comments on the key points that were made in the documents that we're now looking at. So I'm not sure if I understand option 2A, where we're adding the global public interest to the mix. I am quite sure that it will not help this discussion if we mix global public interest with human rights. So I would strongly advise to keep two separated. I think in 2B, say defer instead of differ, just to make things clear, and then I'll give it up to the next person in the queue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Niels. 2E, the intent behind 2E was to say that 2A, is basically keeping recommendation 6 as is, and since the board raised a concern that it would have to assess this recommendation based on potential global public interest issues, the recommendation would be, in that case, to provide our own view on whether recommendation 6 does raise global public interest concerns. But I think that's consistent with what you were asking, and I'm just, and that's probably not for immediate answer for the board, but I think Neil's question regarding any documentation that the board would have received during its preparation on human rights recommendation that it would lead to a significant increase in lawsuits, for instance. So if the board has some documentation or insights provided by advisors, I think it would be extremely helpful if it could be shared with this group. And I'm noting this question for maybe the recap at the end. But the next in line is Tatiana. Tatiana, you may be on mute. No, we can't hear you at this point. Tatiana, I suggest we move to Cavus and come back to you. Yes, we will come back to you after Cavus. Cavus?
Yes, that's you. First, last night, GAC has the first meeting, and among the discussions, we refer to recommendation 6, and certainly CCWG will receive a reply from GAC before 21st of January in regard with recommendation 6 that they generally are in favor in saying that there should be a in the form of the broad principle-based interim bylaw the key parameters to the ICANN commitment to respecting human rights. So you will receive something, number one. Number two, I have some difficulty to see whether C is an alternative of A and B. It may be some sort of the extension or complement. A and B could be alternative to each other in one way or other, but C is not really an alternative. So before you're taking decision on any of these two, you have to clarify whether C is a real independent alternative to A and B, or is it complementary to B? Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. That's a good point. In light of timing, I will close the queue after Bruce, but next is Tatiana.
Hi, I hope you can hear me now.
Very well. Thank you, Tatiana.
Oh, thank you very much. So I'm going to elaborate a bit on what Niels told about discussion points, because I think they have to be fine-tuned. So as far as I understand, the point 2A, option 2A, refers to the global public interest, and basically what this point, this option means is that we will just proceed with the bylaw language. And I think that rather than referring to the GPI issue, to global public interest, which will definitely get us down the rabbit hole, because we could see from the previous calls how diverse the opinion on this issue are. Maybe we can modify it to something like confirmed by law language as a part of Workstream 2 with legal opinion addressing the issue of the risk of litigation. Because basically, why did the board refer to the global public interest? It was about the risk of litigation, which will disturb provision of the ICANN services in the global public interest. So if we'll have a real legal analysis and opinion addressing the issue of the risk of litigation, I think the question of GPI should be solved anyway. So this is my suggestion for the point 2A. Well, option 2B, as Marcus said, of course it's a valid option, but so many people will disagree with this. I don't think it's real. And for the sake of clarification, I think that the option 2C shall be reformulated a bit, because it is not clear that we will confirm the bylaw language in the workstream 1. So I think that we have to clarify that we will adjust the bylaw language as a part of workstream 2, but clarify that it will only be enforced after the framework for implementation is approved in workstream 2, because I think there is a bit of confusion what is going to be addressed and in which work stream in the option 2C. Once it's clarified, and I think, I mean, it definitely means that we will get bylaw in the work stream 1, but it would be dormant till the framework of implementation is approved. So that's my short suggestions. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Tatiana. That's very helpful, and we'll certainly refine these definitions. Next in the queue is Tijani.
Thank you, Matteo. Do you hear me?
Yes, very well, Tijani.
Thank you very much, Tijani speaking. I think it's not only the board that made this kind of comment. I have seen some other comments about it, and I think that the proposal you make here to A, to B, to C, to B would be the best in my point of view. If you remember well, at the beginning we decided inside the group to address the human rights in Workstream 2, full stop. And then some from the group wanted to address it in Workstream 1. And the consensus was to make a very high-level education about human rights in Workstream 1, in the report of Workstream 1, and address it in Workstream 2. The fear was the explanation, the interpretation of human rights because of the mission, the very limited mission of ICANN. So now I think that the best is to choose to be so that we will stick to what we decided in the working group when we decided to address it in Workstream 1. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you, Tijani. Next in line is Niels.
Thank you very much, Macho. I am a bit confused by what Tijani said before, because I think what we have currently is a high-level commitment in Workstream 1 and the framework in Workstream 2. So that's exactly according to what Tijani requested, but still he preferred option 2B, whereas that sound for me like option 2A. So I am slightly confused by that. So perhaps you could elaborate a bit on that. And according to 2A, the comment you just made, I am not sure if whether the board asks for a public interest a definition or a relevance there, whether the CCWG should define it. As we all know, we have a whole process within ICANN to develop the global public interest. So if the board is going to invoke or talk about global public interest here, I think the board should come up with the discussion, and we should not get into the muddy waters of the global public interest discussion here with human rights, and definitely not conflate the two issues, because that will really not help us forward, in my humble opinion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Niels. Now, for Bruce, for the last intervention on this first meeting before we try and define a way forward. Bruce?
Yes, thank you. Firstly, let me agree with Niels. I think there's no point in conflating the two issues. I would have thought by default human rights is in the global public interest. Just picking up, I had a couple of questions about the legal analysis. The legal analysis is actually in our comments, or at least from my perspective, and I'm not a lawyer. But I think the key point here is that of the three options we have, obviously we preferred the second option, which is it gets dealt with in Workstream 2. But I recognise that some people may not have faith that WorkStream 2 will deliver. And so 2C, I think, is a potentially viable option. And the key about that is because it refers back to our board comments. We're afraid that without properly defining what the human rights means in the context of ICANN's mission, which, to be frank, is about names and numbers, domain names and numbers. We don't deal with most of the topics like human slavery and other things that might be in the human rights treaty. So our first point really is rather than have an IRP start to create case law, because the IRP becomes binding. So if we just go in without any definition at all, the IRP will basically start defining it for us. And we think that the ICANN community should define how human rights relates to the Internet Protocol parameters, how it relates to the IP addresses, and how it relates to domain names. That really should be done as an ICANN community exercise. And once that's defined, then the IRP can then use it as a criteria in making its determination. So that's the first point. The other point we had there was about applicable law. As most of you realise, the international human rights is a treaty, but it's actually implemented as national law in different countries and varies quite a bit. So the question is, what would be the applicable law? Is it the law in the US, in California? Is it the law where the party raising the IRP is based? That's not clear either. So again, I think it's better that we define how human rights works within our context, and then we have an IRP to look to make sure that we're adhering to those concepts. And then the last point we had was that ICANN doesn't have direct power to bind, you know, parties, which could be registrants or, you know, domain name owners, etc., or domain name holders, and trying to define how they're using domain names in the context of human rights. We don't generally go as far as trying to control the registrants of domain names. So those are sort of the legal issues that we raised. And so I think that our preferred option is that we work on how human rights works in WorkStream 2. And another comment was, I've just got a text here saying we're also not clear how it would work with CCTLDs because country codes operate within their own national law typically, and they would use whatever the national law relates to human rights rather than something that you know, might be defined in somewhere else in the world. So I think prefer that we do this in WorkStream 2. If you need a hook in the bylaws, then I think we can look at some sort of hook in the bylaws that says, you know, human rights is an important core value, but that it's not subject to IRP until we've defined the framework. I think that's, you know, a potential compromise.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce. And I think that's a useful clarification you're bringing about the board's concern being that the IRP would be defining the human rights commitment in the during the time the framework of interpretation would not yet be approved by the community, and I think that's a point that I hadn't really nailed down at this until then. The queue was closed, and I think it is time for us to move forward. But Tatiana and Kavuz, can you be very short?
Yes, just to reply to Bruce, applicable law, it is intentionally put it as such, depending the area in which the IRP is initiated, but not necessarily the California law. So I don't know why and how Bruce want to have a clear definition of a given particular law. It is as such, it depends where the IRP is initiated and law of that country is applicable. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavuz. And Tatiana, you have the privilege of closing this discussion.
Thank you, Matthew. I hope everyone can hear me well. Tatiana Tropina is speaking. Well, thanks to Bruce for the clarification. I totally agree that the framework of interpretation shall follow the bylaw, and the bylaw cannot be really fully affected without this framework, and it shall be a community exercise. Well, I have 3 points. First of all, I do think that most of the bylaws, comments, and concerns about litigations are already addressed in the bylaw text, because there is something about bylaw not meaning that ICANN should enforce and protect human rights, and then anyone can raise claims about these. This is my first point. But if it's not enough, then the issue of the applicable law. I think there is a big misunderstanding about the role of the corporations and the role of the governments in enforcing human rights. And I will not go into this discussion right now because it's a long discussion. But if we are talking about applicable law and what corporations can be enforced to do in applicable law in almost any jurisdiction I know, I am not aware about any jurisdiction where applicable law will mean that corporation will be forced to enforce human rights in the court. This is my second point. And my third point, I also think that options 2C actually addresses all the concerns about the IRPs quite well, because it will make this bylaw dormant before the framework is implemented. Well, I think this would be the best case. So I think we can discuss the possibility of this option if no one will be happy with the option 2A to proceed with what we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tatiana. And in light of this discussion, we'll reconvene for a second reading on Recommendation 6 in a week's time. Until then, we will benefit from extra lawyer input from our independent lawyers. Any extra material that the board would have and would like to share is, of course, very welcome, but we had some clear clarifications and additions from Marcus and Bruce, I think, on the board's insights. And we have there's certainly some interest expressed for Approach 2C with some modifications as proposed by Tatiana. So we'll sort of reframe this in the next couple of days for consideration from everyone. Sorry for the background noise. We invite everyone to consider this with their respective groups before our second reading. And with that, I will move to Leon for next agenda item. Leon.
Thank you very much, Matthew. And the next agenda item is an update on the mission ad hoc meeting that took place. And for that, I would turn to Becky to provide us with an update on how the call went and where we're standing on Recommendation 5, which is the mission statement. So, Becky, could you please take the floor?
Thanks very much, Leon. I wanted to had a very good full hour call this morning on specifically on the consumer trust issue, which we did not discuss at great length last week. Just for a recap for those of you who weren't on this morning. The affirmation of commitment has a reference in paragraph 3, which describes what the affirmation of commitment does, that references consumer competition, consumer trust, and consumer choice. And then in section 9.3 obligates ICANN specifically to conduct reviews related to, among other things, consumer protection provisions with respect to the expansion of new GTLDs. In the first draft, we transposed the consumer trust language into Article 1, into the core values. We took that out in draft two and draft three on the grounds that is being challenged, that the consumer trust language was specific to a new GTLD expansion and should relate to that, and that we shouldn't add a new substantive provision, substantive obligation, scope of responsibility to Article 1. AILAC, USCIB, and others have continued to challenge that determination. And note, while the bylaws, the core values do speak to the promotion of competition, they do not speak to consumer trust issues. We had a very lengthy discussion about that. I'm afraid to say that we did not really reach any solutions on that. AILAC and others continue to express a strong conviction that Article 1 should specifically reference ICANN's role with respect to consumer trust. Other participants equally strongly felt that we should not lightly add a new substantive obligation with respect to consumer trust, consumer protection in the core values where it has not ever been to this point without understanding fully the consequences of that, the effect for mission creep, and the concerns about consumer protection laws, sovereignty, and the like. We're trying to resolve this I did go back through the bylaws provisions, Article 1, while we did transpose the affirmation of commitments in, we didn't really add any wholly new concepts like this. We did not reach any conclusions. We're continuing to work on this, and I think we'll just have to continue to report back.
Thank you very much, Becky. So I guess this would be the update on the call, and if there are any comments at this point, I guess it's time for you to actually raise your hands and comment on the update that we just got from Becky. Otherwise, if there are no comments, I would like to move forward and go to the next agenda item. Okay, so I see Caboose hand is up. Caboose, could you please take the floor?
Yes, just a small point. We have received comments from ERASAC relating to amending the missions. I just ask whether we are taking into account that we have received similar comments from IAB that instead of coordinate in the mission, we mentioned facilitate the coordination. Just a small aide-mémoire. Thank you.
Thank you very
and
much.
Leon, I can answer that. We did incorporate the IAB language. I don't believe that there's any issue with respect to that language in the comments.
Thank you very much, Becky, for answering Kapoor's question. And if there are no more comments on this issue, as I said, I would like to move forward to the next agenda item. And for that, I will turn to my co-chair, Matthew.
Thank you very much, Leon. And this is a more informal, or at least less substantial item regarding the Marrakesh meeting. As announced last week, travel support from ICANN will reach out to members for the March 4th full-day face-to-face meeting, where we will be discussing most probably Workstream 2 scoping, as well as some Workstream 1 implementation, hopefully updates. So travel support will reach out to members. We'll have the same policy in place as for previous meetings, including the possibility for alternates for members. We are also working on the agenda of meetings for the week. After the full-day working session on March the 4th, we're trying to locate slots for an engagement session, hopefully on the Monday. And another closing working session on the Thursday in order to organize our work moving forward. So that's going to, obviously, there will also be some ASOAC sessions depending on their respective agendas. But that's the way we are currently shaping the Marrakesh meeting, and we wanted to update you all on this important development. I want to stress the very constructive discussions that we've had with Teresa, who was there on the call last week for that matter. And I think ICANN has been very receptive to our group's demands, and that must be noted and acknowledged by everyone. This is very much appreciated in terms of support, and it's a significant effort that's being made for to accommodate our group. Next, Kavush, you may want to raise a point about Marrakesh?
Yes, you mentioned Monday to have an engagement meeting. Monday is a high-level meeting of the GAC, and many people that are involved. Do you plan this difficulty with that, to create a difficulty with the participants of that meeting, not to be able to attend the engagement meeting? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavush. The point of an engagement meeting is to reach out to stakeholders that are not necessarily part of our group. And so I don't think participation from everyone, every participant and member is a requirement. However, you are right that we need to avoid clashing with high-level meeting as much as possible, and we'll convey this request to the full group. Thank you for raising this. Are there any other points? No. Yes, Tijani?
Thank you very much, Mathieu. Thank you very much, Mathieu. I think that we need to have the dates and the hours of the engagement session. If there is there is two, you said, one on Monday and one on Thursday. If you can have the timing of those sessions, it would be better for us to organize ourselves so that a maximum number of the working group will be attending these sessions. Thank you.
Thank you, Tijani. That's very reasonable, and that's what we're working at right now. Hilary, the meetings team, and all our support staff are frantically trying to nail down the slots right now. So I think we'll try to provide this as early as possible, obviously. And I think with that, we can close this item and move to AOB with Leon. Leon.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. And at this point, if there are any other business that anyone wants to raise, this is the point to shoot, so I see Alan Greenberg's hand is up. Alan?
Thank you. There was a question on the list of, can we have a revised timeline? Clearly, the timeline where we make our decision by January 22nd
is no longer operable, and what is the envisioned timeline we're talking about now?
Thank you very much, Alan. And I believe that Thomas replied to the question, and at this point we cannot provide you with a revised timeline. We need to wait for the feedback from the SOs and ACs that are pending to provide their feedback. So once we have that in hand, then we will be able to assess and evaluate any modifications to the timeline. So at this point, it is clear that we are not on track with the timeline that was sent to the list as a reference, but it is also clear that we are not able to provide with a revised timeline until we get the feedback from all SOs and ACs. But as soon as this happens, we will be, of course, reaching out to the group with the proposed amended timeline. Caboose, I see your hand up.
The timeline is important as far as the ICG is concerned. Tomorrow night we have our meeting and we have to have something. So as far as you mentioned that we don't have any clear idea about the timeline, I hope this timeline would not have any impact on the ICG activities. Can you please confirm that?
Thank you very much, Caboose. We cannot assure at this point whether the revised timeline will have an impact on ICG or not, because, as I said, we are not able to provide a revised timeline at this point. So we can also not assure that this will not impact the ICG. It is, of course, our intention to avoid impacting ICG's timeline, but at this point we cannot know for sure whether this is actually an accurate statement or if it will, in the end, impact ICG's timeline. Okay, so are there any other business at this point? Well, seeing no more hands up, as I assume that Caboo's hand is an old hand, I would like to thank everyone for attending this call. It's been a good call, and as soon as we have the revised documents, we will be circulating those to the list, and of course this also applies to the timeline. And we would like to thank you again, and this call is now adjourned. Thanks everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye everyone.